This is the State of Things from the Upstage Cabaret at Triad Stage in downtown Greensboro. I'm Frank Stacio. In 2006, author Craig Nova was judged for the National Book Award, so he read hundreds and hundreds of books and began to notice a pattern. He detected what he calls the disappearance of a loving male character in fiction, and this led Craig Nova to explore what it means to be a decent man. His latest novel is called The Constant Heart. It follows a father and son through their struggle to sacrifice for the ones they love. And it was recently put on the New Yorker's list of best books of 2012. Craig Nova is an author and a professor in the humanities at the University of North Carolina at Greensboro and my guest on The State of Things. Craig Nova, welcome. So first I want you to paint the picture of being a judge for the National Book Awards. You've got these, what, boxes of books that you...
Well, you know, it really is a bizarre experience. There's no two ways about it. In fact, there was another judge who said that her kids had built a fort, and a very large fort, out of the books that had arrived. I must have read hundreds of novels.
Wow. And so tell us about this pattern you noticed, this idea.
Well, you know, one of the things I noticed was that a character that had previously existed in books was no longer obvious. That is, a decent, moral, trustworthy a man who was willing to be devoted to somebody else and even sacrifice himself in the service of trying to help somebody.
Maybe this just points to the limits of fiction.
I don't know about that. I think that, in fact, previously, I can think of a number of books where there were characters like that that simply don't exist. One of them is a book called Goodbye, So Long, See You Tomorrow by William Maxwell, who was editor of The New Yorker and also a fine novelist. It's a novel about a man who spends his life trying to come to terms with what he thinks is a failure and not being a good enough human being in helping a friend of his whose parents were murdered.
So do you detect here, a sense that this character just isn't popular anymore? That it's, in other words, it's easy enough to bash the male character, the male.
I would say that these days, and that's one of the things I think is a little dangerous, it's the default setting. Mm. It's so much easier for a writer to avoid any accusation of any kind from any group if the morally suspect person in a novel is a man.
Well, tell us about your book, The Constant Heart. Give us a little.
Well, there are a number of things that, believe me, it's not only about the fact that it's about trying to write characters who are both male and decent. It has to do with a number of things. One of them is what I call the Romeo and Juliet syndrome, which is that I think that young people at a certain age, when they're teenagers, can fall in love in a way that is impossible at any other age, mainly because their first personalities are not completely formed, and so there's this illusion of complete devotion to one another. The book is about a young man and a young woman who have had that experience and then separated, went their various ways for 10 years, and then got back together. Woman is in real trouble, what can only be called real trouble. The man has gone to university and become an astronomer, and it's a very unlikely combination, but he tries to get her out of the trouble that she's in.
And so, and as you say, deep trouble, she gets into the trouble because of her heart. It's well-intentioned, but she's
yes,
in deep.
Yes, right. She certainly does. She sees something that seduces her into doing something she should not do. It is the correct thing to do. It's the right thing to do. It's the moral thing to do. But it causes a lot of trouble.
You know, you touch on something that I think is very important in this whole discussion, and that is sort of the nature of love itself, the idea that when we're unformed, we become codependent on each other, and we find in each other something. Mm. And that is an idea that seems to be lost in fiction. It's there are power relationships. And, of course, exploring those power relationships is important. But the notion that love is power, that somehow we get our way, that if you love me, let me have my way, seems to be a dominant idea and not the idea that I sacrifice in order to enter more deeply into love.
Well, I think the way it really works in fact and is the basis of any long-term relationship is that it's not a matter of getting your way. In fact, I think the key to a successful long-term relationship of any variety is that each member of a couple feels that he or she is doing 75% of the work.
Well, and exactly, and I think it's well put. And so that leads to the kind of the sorrow of manhood in the modern age, because of course all of our descriptions of maleness have been around power. And so is that our sorrow? It's redefining maleness in a way that doesn't require power to be at the center.
You know, I think that the key to masculinity in the modern age, or so it seems to me, it can be seen in some of my heroes. I mean, my heroes are someone like Paul Farmer, who founded Partners in Health, practiced half of the year in Boston and slept on the floor of his office so he could go to Haiti and provide for free medical care, and started an enormous organization that produced health care in Haiti. I think that there are many, many men who are quietly going about their lives devoted to doing a decent and worthwhile thing. And also, they're much more quiet about it than they used to be. I mean, they really are very reticent.
Would you read for us? And maybe you can set up this passage.
Yeah, sure. Actually, you know, in this book, the woman, the main character's name is Sarah, and she's done a number of things, but she ends up selling cars. And this is a little description of her selling a car, and somebody who comes into the showroom where she works, and she sees something that really is at the heart of a thing that ultimately gets her into a lot of trouble. So Sarah is a woman who sells cars, Subarus actually, this is the thing that she sees that gets her into trouble later. A man, about 40, a little overweight, balding, usually wearing a suit that was one day overdue at the dry cleaner, came in and said, "Hi, Sarah." And she'd say hi and get up, and they'd go from car to car in the showroom, and she'd go through her list of things about each car, and the guy, whose name was Jack Michaels, sort of like two first names, he said, leaned close to her, nodded his head, got behind the wheel, worked the gear shift on the stick shifts. Then he'd get out and close the door. "Nothing like the sound of a new door on a new car," he said. "Better than a freezer, way better than a freezer." And followed her into the cubicle where Sarah took out the loan forms and the purchase and sale agreement, but he waved them away just as he had been doing for a couple of months. Instead, he took out his wallet and he showed her a picture of his daughter, about 12, Sarah guessed. And at first he would only say that sometimes she was losing weight and that he went without lunch to buy her a cream puff or something else, like a brisket sandwich or a quart of ice cream. But she'd only have a bite and then begin to cry and say that she wanted to eat more but couldn't. "You could see," said Sarah, "from the pictures that he showed, one after another, a sort of serial of pictures of the girl whose name was Nadia, was losing weight. Jack sold novelties like belly button lint, and he had a little case on wheels that he rolled from store to store, although he said the internet was killing him. He even gave Sarah a guaranteed cockroach killer. It was two blocks. Place cockroach on block A. Strike sharply with block B." That kind of thing. He said, after they looked over the cars, and Sarah had shared half a tuna sandwich with Jack, which he ate in small bites to make it last longer, he said, "Do you know what nephritis is?" And when Sarah said she didn't, he explained that it was a kidney disease and that Nadia needed a transplant, but a lot of people did, and she was on a waiting list, which, he guessed, was as long as the names in the Manhattan telephone directory. And Jack said, Nadia's got this little case, suitcase, all packed and ready to go, just in case we get the call. But I think, Jack said, we'd have better luck if we could just buy a kidney. Sarah said she thought that was illegal. He asked her if she would do anything illegal to save someone she loved. She said she hoped it would work out. He sat there with a quarter of a tuna sandwich in front of him and said, yeah, let's hope.
Craig Nova, reading from his latest novel, The Constant Heart. So there we have a couple of things going on. Certainly this idea that men and women, that this role that women can play, any kind of listening ear will play to someone who has a story to tell. And in comes this guy, the belly button salesman, of all people, and he begins pouring his heart out to her. She takes up the challenge of getting involved in this illegal activity and needs to be rescued. So let me ask you about that, because here in Jake we have a character who plays a kind of a typical powerful, though, male role. In other words, the woman gets in trouble and the man comes to the rescue. I mean, what about that?
Well, I think that, it goes to the very heart of what's going on between these two characters. I mean, after all, right from their earliest age, they play dangerous games and got into trouble together. So when he finds that... that she's in trouble, it's natural to him that he would help her. And in fact, his father's also having trouble, and when he and his father have trouble, they go on a fishing trip together. And Sarah, who is trying to escape the people who are pursuing her, hides in their car when they're going fishing. So in a way, she brings trouble into their lives all by herself. It's not that Jake, the male character, runs off to protect her. She comes to him and actually disguises herself until she's part of his life when they're in the middle of no place and some very bad guys are after them.
Still, you could be criticized by those people who you worry about, who you talked about earlier, for, again, creating the damsel in distress, right?
Yeah, it's not that she's in distress, it's that she's been morally correct, and, I guess I want to stand up for her morality.
Well, she is an actor in her own life, so she's an agent of change. She's done things. She wasn't put in the castle.
No, she is in no way a victim. In fact, one of the things about her that is I find most appealing is that she is absolutely unpredictable and capable of incredible fury at a moment's notice. In fact, there's a scene at one point in the novel where she and Jake are in the store, but it's being held up by a guy and says some unsavory things to Sarah, and Jake is afraid she's going to blow her top and let the guy have it right there, even though he's holding him.
Yeah, because that's her history. And we've talked about Jake and Sarah and their relationship, of course, central to this, but you framed it in the relationship, inside the relationship of Jake to his father, too. Tell us about that and why you chose to do that.
Actually, something else I've noticed when I was reading for the National Book Award, and also generally reading, after all, I'm a novelist, that's my job. My job is to know what everyone else is doing. And I noticed that another relationship was disappearing from modern fiction, which is a son who actually loves his father and a father who actually loves his son. In this case, the two are really very close. And Jake even says, my father never lectured me, but by example, by being a decent, caring human being, shows Jake how to live. A good example of that is that Jake's mother has an affair, and Jake's father slowly and definitely and with great sincerity forgives her. And the relationship continues as they really do in real life. I mean, people do forgive each other, and that's one of the undercurrents of the book is forgiveness and understanding, and not being self-righteous.
And another overtone in all of this is the fact that, as you say, Jake has become an astronomer. Cosmology plays an important part of this. In fact, it goes to the title as well, right?
Yeah, that's right. Actually, the constant heart has two meanings. One, of course, is being constantly concerned and loving to somebody. The other part of it is Einstein's cosmology. cosmological constant, which he introduced into his equations of relativity, because he didn't like the idea of a universe that the theory predicted of which was unstable. So he wanted to add something that would make it stable. When in fact, it not only is the universe expanding, it's accelerating. So the value of the constant may actually determine the amount of so-called dark matter in the universe. But my point in using it was to try to make a connection between the scale of a cosmological and the fact that enormous things like galaxies are about to disappear because they're going on beyond the horizon of observation. After all, light bends, and after a certain point, there's certain things we can't see.
Well, and it's fascinating, too, that Einstein called it his greatest mistake was to try to come up with this because he didn't like what his theory told him. So he made up a new theory, and it turned out to be wrong. or at least not utterly proven.
It may be right, but not in the way that he originally thought. You know, but
he did worry a little bit that he wasn't being true to his craft in the sense that and that's what you have to do, I suppose, too, as a novelist. Again, you're supposed to know what people are doing, kind of reflect that, and that becomes part of the challenge of the artist as well.
Well, I think that the challenge of writing a novel are two things. I know many people have tried to write novels, and usually they give up because they can't tolerate imperfection. Writing a novel, it doesn't come out, nice and neat and clean at the end of the first draft, but after the 15th or 20th or 25th, or God knows.
You've just discouraged three-quarters of the audience right now. You got up to 20, I think that did it. But it's true, Ibsen said you have to write a bad play before you can write a good one.
Well, actually, years ago, the Washington Post asked me to do a little essay for them about the writing life, and I told them that I write at a minimum 10 to 1, that is, for a manuscript of 500 pages. I'll write 5,000, minimum. And I save all the pages and wrap them up, and they didn't believe me. So I had my youngest daughter stand in front of a wall of his bundles, which at that point I figured was 36,000 sheets, and it's substantially more than that now. And so I sent them a picture, and I called the people at the Washington Post on the phone, and I could hear this gasp in their voice. I wasn't kidding.
So what's it like to teach? I mean, you were an accomplished writer before you came here, and then you're now facing students. What did that do for you?
For 25 years in Vermont, I wrote novels and did a little work for the movie business. Thank God none of the scripts I wrote were produced. but it certainly helped pay tuition. So what happened to me is after 25 years, this opportunity came up at the University of North Carolina, and I wanted to come. And actually, the benefit for me is that I had to codify the things I knew but I never really explained to myself. And right now I have a group of students who are just an absolute delight to spend time with, talking about books and writing and trying to convey some of those things I learned alone in a room.
Did it help you as a writer? Did it improve your writing to actually be able to articulate what it was you were doing?
You'll notice that actually in this last year I'm publishing two books, one in June and one in September. And part of that comes from the fact that I've been able to articulate to myself exactly what it was I was doing by bumbling all those years in Vermont.
Well, we'll have to have you back for your next book. Craig Nova, thank you so much for being
with
us.
Thank you.
Craig Nova, author and professor in the humanities at the University of North Carolina at Greensboro, his latest book, The Constant Heart. We're going to take a break, come back with Bruce Pioff and Scott Sawyer, talk with them, hear their music, and here they are right now to play us out.
The owls so loudly they sleep in silken avalanche and circumspection. They twist and they turn full circle with the churn of masquerading saints and introspection. Queen and Slay's Promethean Grace and the shadowed sideshows. Pyramids pace and painted face to the twilight temptress's door. And the dying giving breath to pale visions they have left. Their buildings float in mist, eclipsed by your kiss.